We're often fond of talking about the money side of retirement, but what about the emotional side? Well, here to talk with me about that and then some is Suzanne Norman. She's a long-term financial educator. Suzanne, welcome.
Hello. Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. We have a lot to get to, but before we dive into the topics, for the benefit of folks who may not be familiar with you and your resume and your history of all the good work that you've done, do you mind giving us an overview?
Sure. I joined the investment industry in 1992. So we're on a financial intelligence podcast, so you can do the math. It's been a long time. I officially retired from my corporate role back in 2021, really to go back to one of my deep passions. I actually have an undergraduate degree in psychology, so that will come out in our conversation today, I'm sure. I went back to really dive into the formal side of coaching. So what I bring to people as a fellow with LIMRA, as a financial educator, as an executive coach, is this blend of my investment industry experience and knowledge, my coaching and psychology, emotional intelligence, and also my lived experience as a woman. And everything I'm doing these days is all about financial empowerment for women and life empowerment for women. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. And we'll talk more about women in a second. I mentioned that we're going to talk about the emotional side of retirement. Many times when I talk to folks, they're always like, do I have enough money? How will I spend it? But very few people think about the emotional side. What do they need to know?
I've written about this, and one of the things that I find interesting is that this is a major life event. This is a critically important life event. And of course, for financial reasons, it's interesting to me that so many of our major life events are celebrated. And we have, you know, events, we have birthday parties, we have anniversary parties, we have graduation parties. And a lot of people look at retirement very differently. So there's an emotional transition that's happening. Some people I know actually have retirement celebrations and they call them graduations, but that's really rare. And so what I've found in the research that I do in the writing is that this is that intersection of that identity shift from what I've been doing, and a lot of times that's career, into this vast unknown. What's coming? So we'll kind of bifurcate it into thinking about, you know, the financial preparation, of course, that's critical, but there isn't necessarily something embedded in the financial advice industry to help people find a new purpose, because purpose can change. I always talk about this as a coach, that core values tend to be set early and those don't change a lot, but the purpose that we have in life can absolutely change. And we get multiple purposes, but retirement's one of those tricky phases where in the financial advice industry, it's all about the money. And it's not necessarily thinking about the full kind of emotional landscape of someone going through a major transition.
Yeah. Would you recommend to folks or to advisors that someone not retire until they've determined what their purpose will be? Or like oftentimes people will say things like, you're not retiring from something, you're retiring to something. And until you understand what the to something is, you ought not retire.
Yeah. I hesitate for making things rules because we're all unique individuals. Interestingly enough, I will be having a call with one of my dear friends, and he is navigating this. We've had this conversation for a number of years. We'll be talking about it tomorrow. I've definitely resourced him with a lot of ways to get prepared. He is still working. So what I think about a lot is really it's exploring, you know, what are those deep passions? And again, we'll separate this from the money right now. So we will talk about that landscape. So what I think you just said, Bob, perfectly is it does create a landing pad for a lot of people. Now, with that being said, I have another dear friend who just retired from a 40-year financial advisor role. She made this plan, this exit, for a number of years. She's a CFP. She's a big planner. However, she's retiring into a blank canvas, as I call it. So she has no agenda. She's financially secure. So again, great financial advisor, CFP. She knows what she's doing there. But what she wanted to create was sort of a playpen. So she had this ability to explore and be creative and not, you know, as she said, wake up and know what day it is. So I don't know that there's one way for everybody, but I am very deeply passionate about helping people pursue their purpose. And there are some workbooks available for people.
Yeah, I recently spoke to Ken Dykewald and Maddie Dykewald, his wife, from AgeWave, and they talked about the four pillars of retirement, community, purpose, health, and finances. And when I think about purpose, I think about like, well, my purpose may be community service. I may not know exactly what I want to do in terms of community service, but I know that's something that I want to explore, and it doesn't have to be, I know it exactly when I retire, right? Like I could, like you said, it could be a playpen, right?
Yeah. Well, I'll share maybe if it's okay, a personal anecdote from my lived experience post sort of career corporate. And that is that I traveled a lot for work, and it was always important to me. I live in, we were adjacent to each other in the Boston area, but I live in a community that is a true neighborhood, but I was coming in and out, you know, and just flying here, there, and everywhere. And I always had this pull to be in the community, walking down the street, and not that I know everybody, but, you know, just sort of, you know, and I will say I live in Beacon Hill and I live near Cheers. So we all know where everybody knows your name. So I had this real call to being in the community. What I've created in 5 years, I reflect on this now because we always have those milestone kind of reflection times. And we always talk about 5-year plans. If I had looked back 5 years ago and seen what I have accomplished today, I wouldn't have believed it. And I'm not saying that this is some huge achievement financially or anything, but what it's created for me is a lived experience to tell people that the playpen combined with what's important. So the purpose for me was absolutely women's empowerment and being in communities of women to help strengthen those ties, be connected. And you know, I've written about this, you know this, I'm sure Ken talked about it. You know, having a purpose adds 7 more years to your life. Blue Zone research, right? But what I've created, I wouldn't have necessarily had a blueprint for that, but being in those putting yourself in those situations that are aligned with the purpose that you have creates, you know, there's a book behind me that you might be able to see, Mind Magic, written by James Doty, who passed last year, but a neuroscientist at Stanford who talks about manifestation. And when I think about manifestation, and he puts science behind it, it's knowing what matters to us, that meaning, that purpose, and it creates a lightning rod, it creates a magnet, and there's all this serendipity that we create. So all to say that combining knowing what you're doing with a little bit of that ingredient of like, let's see what happens, creates some really interesting experiences.
Yeah. I'm fond of Beacon Hill for many reasons, but one reason in particular is that it was the home to the very first village in the United States. And here in my hometown, we've tried to replicate what occurred in Beacon Hill. There's now a village-to-village network of hundreds of communities like Beacon Hill, where they're making it easier for older adults to age in place or age in community.
Mm-hmm. I love that you reference that. We don't talk enough about the village-to-village network and the Beacon Hill Village, yes, being the first. And it's interesting to me because with all the work that I've done in this space, I don't have as close ties to them. Now I'm getting into the age group, having just turned 60, that it's probably more relevant for me. But yes, it's a great, great resource to recommend. And I do talk about it with people in other parts of the country and the world, that this idea of creating that community is so important to our longer lifespans, especially for women. Yes. Yeah.
I do want to move on to other topics, but before I leave the emotional side, there's one question I have, and it sort of haunts me as I think about my own retirement, where in my career, I feel like I'm relevant, and if, were I to retire, I would feel like I became irrelevant. And I think that's a doorstep to go over that's hard for some people to go from being somebody to maybe being nobody.
I agree. And I think that comes back to doing the work. It may be, again, that the blueprint is you know, in pencil, right? We have to put it in pen. Having that knowledge of what those core values are that carry us through our entire lives, having some work that we can do to connect, as Richard Leiter talks about, you know, our gifts and our passions, and getting to that purpose. Because if we can use that as, and maybe, you know, we're in Boston, home base, right? You know, thinking about baseball, home base, that it becomes that check-in. Because I still have to do it myself, because we get so wired into this career, this income, this measuring stick. And in fact, the friend that I'm talking to tomorrow morning, he and I have talked about this before, where time is different now. Now, yes, it moves faster. We all know that weird science with aging. But I think it also, with goal-oriented career, you know, minded, or the mindset of like, oh, you know, I'm in a deadline, and it changes. It's really interesting. So connecting that to maybe a positive, which is, oh, you know, maybe I wake up and I'm not quite sure what it is that I'm going to do today, but oh, right, let's check in. You know, what's my purpose and what am I doing to create that connection to my purpose every day? And again, there's a little work involved in that, but it's not hard. It's not.
Yeah. All right, so that's the emotional side. Let's talk about the money side for a second. We spend our lives creating the savings habit, and then we get to retirement, and now we have to spend down these accumulated assets that we have. And oftentimes, and I'm sure you've seen this in your career as well, oftentimes people get to the end of retirement with more money in their accounts than when they began because they don't want to spend the money for whatever reason. And David Blanchett, Michael Finca, you, others have talked about this need to create a license to spend. Talk about, like, how do we get people to enjoy the money that they've accumulated, especially in the go-go years?
Yeah, it's a great paper. So License to Spend, I recommend everybody take a look at this. The conservation effect, and again, I'll come back to women a lot. There's a term that I don't love, but it is out there, so I'll reference it, which is the bag lady syndrome, which is this fear of outliving your money. And there's survey after survey after survey, and again, making a distinction between, of course, there are some people that have not saved enough. Let's kind of put that in a category. Now let's maybe focus on the people that have spent enough. The industry has been built around accumulation. So this, again, is not a new story. But what I think is happening there is, again, the tension of an industry that is paid on assets under management, combined with someone who may have that kind of limbic system fear of, oh, you know, I don't want to see this dollar amount go down. That's loss aversion. We all know prospect theory and behavioral finance. And then combined with the reality of people living much longer. So we have all these forces at play that I think create this fear of spending money. In fact, I will share a story from last week. A friend of mine called me and said, you know, and a woman, I don't think it matters gender-wise, but she said, I feel guilty when I call my financial advisor and say I need to take money. And I said, well, there is a whole library of content about this and all the forces that I just mentioned that are at play. And I said, this is an education moment for people, which is, you know, what is the spending plan? Because we all have this jargon in our industry about decumulation. Decumulation is a spending plan. And the challenge that Jason Fichtner and I have written about in this, you know, Gen X Peak 65 era is that, you know, you do have this broken stool. So we talk about retirement, of course, having the three components of income, right? So we've got, you know, traditionally pensions, Social Security, personal savings. And again, putting the lens on Gen X here and baby boomers, maybe not as impacted, but the fact that Social Security, whatever that discussion is for policy and funding, the fact is that it's a fear that people have of, you know, will I, you know, be paid less or will I, you know, have a tax that hits that income? Pensions, we know, have gone down to about 4% for the Gen X population. So it's all to say that this idea of spending in retirement needs to be the primary conversation if someone is in getting advice from a financial advisor, or let's say they're doing it themselves, is what does that conversion look like? And checking in on those emotions.
Yeah. I think when I think about people's aversion to spending in retirement, I think about like the Society of Actuaries has, what, 15 risks that you'll face in retirement: longevity, inflation, sequence of return risk, healthcare shocks, change in housing status, whatever it might be. And all those risks play into this notion of, like, well, if I face any of those risks, longevity or inflation, I'm trying to create certainty out of uncertainty. And that's a really hard for the average person who, like, right, who spent their life saving and now they have to deal with, like, well, I don't know how to manage and mitigate these risks to ensure that I still have a pot of money at the end of my retirement to fund my desired standard of living.
Yeah. So we'll go back to Michael and David's paper, License to Spend, which was fascinating research that actually asked the subjects of the study, what would they rather have, $10,000 in income, extra income a year, or another $140,000? So it was an inheritance kind of question. So this is sort of the found money. More people wanted the $10,000. And so why was that? And what you just referenced, Bob, is that idea of certainty. And people really want certainty. And when we think about all these unknowns, because When you think about lifespans, it's the lived experience. So the friend I referenced last week who felt guilty about saying I need some money, my money, said, oh, I know my life expectancy. It's not 100. Now, this is a woman. The reality is, because she's living well, and the old saw in insurance is the longer you live, the longer you live, right? Is that certainty is going to be more and more important for people as they age, and having that ability to spend what they've saved, because having this over conservation is really kind of sad when you think about all this work that was put in, literally work hours, but all the time and effort your financial advisor, put into owning the right things and feeling like that's not your money to spend. There's a huge gap here. So using guaranteed income sources like annuities, because again, pensions are going away for many people. Social Security may not necessarily be the income source that people are predicting. So having that income stream that we can create from some of our savings, not all of them, but some of them into guaranteed income, really takes that psychological pressure off.
Yeah. And I think, like, obviously there's an aversion to people buying annuities for whatever reason. But what you just said seems to make sense, which is, if you're buying it for a portion of your expenses, maybe there was a paper that was just published by Morningstar by Sebastian Gomez, where he looked at what percent of your expenses are essential relative to total expenses. And what he said was, like, you really want to create reliable sources of income for your essential expenses over the course of your retirement, which tend to increase while your income declines in retirement. And for many people, if Social Security is one source, and then there's a gap between that and the other essential expenses, an income annuity makes sense to cover that gap, right? It's sort of like you're creating certainty, you're making sure that all your essential expenses are covered for the rest of your life. How do you get over the aversion? Like, is it really just sort of saying, like, we're only using, it's a product to meet a need? Is that sort of the essence of it?
Yeah, I've been in this space serving this community for many years. And one of the things that I always find interesting is this binary reaction, both from an advisor standpoint and a consumer standpoint. I think the consumers are definitely more aware of the utility of an annuity, meaning now they understand what it does. It's not just what it is. Now, clearly, you know, anything you own, you need to do due diligence. With that being said, though, back to what is the job at hand and what are the tools that are available? So maybe the job that I'm doing in the house requires a hammer, or, you know, it might require a screwdriver. So recognizing as a, you know, both an investor and a financial professional, that this is just one of the tools that you have in the toolbox. And I think, again, back to this binary nature, we always want to simplify as humans, back to the brain. We can only take in so much. Recognizing that it's in the gray area. Because I think a lot of times, you know, maybe a financial advisor isn't licensed to use them. So that's maybe the first question as an educated consumer is, will this advisor actually have this tool for me if I need it? So if they have it, it's recognizing, again, it's not everything, right? It's not, you know, you're not going to have 100% stocks, 100% bonds, you know. So making sure that there's this idea to think about it as in a portfolio design. And so I think that some of the aversion has been, of course, in both camps, consumer, investor, and advisor, complexity. And I think that it's the marketplace has done a better job of explaining what it does and recognizing that this is, you know, a, you know, ability to get guaranteed income. You mentioned already this work that many people are still avoiding, which is have a plan. And at the core, I do a lot of financial literacy education, have a budget. Call it a spending plan, whatever you call it, but that's the work that people need to do, is figuring out what are those needs, what are your wants, and then, of course, if there's money left over, what are your wishes? And then recognizing that the annuity can fit the bill really well in that needs section.
Yeah. You mentioned an analogy that I'm fond of, the toolkit analogy, and I often say, well, you would never go to a doctor who could only prescribe half the medications available. You would never use a carpenter who only had a hammer in their toolbox. Do you think, from a consumer perspective, they ought to work with an advisor that has the full set of tools available? Like, if you go to an advisor who doesn't have the ability to sell insurance, so to speak, or doesn't have an affiliation with someone who can, that you're losing out, right? Ultimately, potentially. Like,
well, thank you. And here's my opinion. My opinion is that in the retirement conversation, if a financial advisor's only risk management tool is portfolio construction, I do think that there's a missing link there. And it also comes back to just thinking about advice in general. And again, it's educating the consumer, the investor, on what questions to ask. There are a lot of interview sheets out there. LIMRA has one that the Alliance for Lifetime Income created, which I love. I use it with all of my friends. The question always has to be, are you just an investment advisor and just helping me with my investment plan? Or are you a comprehensive wealth advisor that's looking at me as a balance sheet of assets and liabilities? And so one of the big things, and I'll take us off the topic of annuities for a minute, that a dear friend of mine brought up years ago, and this is when I was at Merrill Lynch, but she was in litigation with someone and said to me as an advisor, please promise me that every single person that walks through your door hears the term umbrella policy. And so I come back to this idea of if you are a life advisor, comprehensive wealth advisor, you're looking at this person's balance sheet and it's not just the investment. So my personal opinion, yes, I want an advisor who, even if they can't offer it, educates me on these elements of my financial life.
Yeah. Well, that gets me to another soapbox issue, which is if you had to create the financial advice industry from scratch, it would look nothing like it does today, right? Where I go to an insurance agent who maybe not manages investments. I go to an investment advisor who doesn't do insurance. I go to a CPA who does nothing of this, right? Just does taxes, right? We've got this crazy system where we've got different regulators, different licenses, different education, different certifications, and the consumer potentially is at a loss to figure out who to trust in that world.
Right. Well, that does get to another topic that I'm deeply passionate about, which is financial education. So, of course, we're in this podcast, Financial Intelligence. We only have 34 states still that require personal finance as at least a semester to graduate high school. Massachusetts, where we live, is now finally, I think, getting it through the legislation. But all to say that if we don't get educated in school, and let's be honest, teenagers don't necessarily want to be educated by their parents. So we may not be learning it at home. Now, yes, social media is out there and there's probably a lot of great content. There's also the trust but verify need. However, without that baseline education and certainly how to interview a financial advisor or see what the offerings look like, that's the biggest gap, is that financial education.
Let's take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk about Peak 65, which you mentioned, Gen X and Baby Boomers. So don't go away. Good to go back? Okay. Welcome back to Decoding Your Money. I'm speaking with Suzanne Norman. Before the break, I said we were going to talk about something called Peak 65 and Gen X. Suzanne, tell us more.
So Jason Fichtner, who many listeners may know, economist, head executive director for the Retirement Income Institute, published a paper a few years ago and coined the term Peak 65. And this idea is that we have the largest group of people in the United States going through this baby boomer wave of turning 65. So by 2030, we'll have more people over 65 than under 18. And this is a seismic shift. So the concept of Peak 65 is we reached the peak number of 60 from people turning 65 last year in 2025, but they're still coming. So this idea of what is happening to them individually, what is happening from policy and society, and this whole lens of retirement and how people can be ready for this. And yes, we did an update to Jason and I to that major paper last year. And that was the Gen X lens. So looking at the next kind of wave coming through, turning 65.
Yeah. Do you find that Gen X is more prepared than boomers were? I sometimes think that the social contract that boomers had was torn away from them as as defined benefits went away and personal savings and reliance on 401ks and IRAs came into existence. But they were ill-prepared for it, whereas Gen Xers maybe had a little bit of longer runway to think about, well, I better start saving in my 401k when I enter the workforce, or not.
I would say Gen X is probably less prepared, and rationale there is, and again, we can have a debate, right? There's no right or wrong answer here, but what we wanted to shine a light on in the paper was the fact of something you referenced, the fact that the three-legged stool of pension, Social Security, personal savings, Gen X historically, or at least, you know, by the numbers we looked at, of course, don't have access at the same number or percentage to defined benefit pension plans. So we went from about 60% of that, you know, boomer population having pensions to about 4% of the Gen X. So that leg of the stool is pretty weak. We've already, I think, talked about Social Security, so no opinion there other than, you know, it's a fear that people have. What happens will happen, but things to be aware of is that there could be less income, there could be more tax. So all to say that it's the personal savings and the 401k, yes, those defined contribution plans became the vehicle. The challenge, again, was everything coming at Gen X. So we've got higher college costs. So a lot of parents were paying for this. Maybe there was higher ed costs that Gen X took on for grad school. And then we've also got the caregiving. And so caregiving, especially for women, which we looked at the AARP did a study last year, and we can see about 60% of the sandwich, you know, caring for children, caring for parents, are done by women. And the average age is 51. So the bullseye in Gen X. So men, of course, are doing care as well. But those things that were happening as far as not necessarily available or pension not available, having to DIY it through a 401k, loans, you know, that leakage that we talk about there, that became something where a pension, you couldn't necessarily get the pension until you retired, right? So there are those headwinds that Gen X is facing that the boomers and the silent generation did not face.
Yeah. Do you think there's been much talk about the amount of money that Gen X will inherit when baby boomers pass on? Is that a parachute? Is that will that bail them out?
It's so interesting, Bob. You would think so. And, you know, looking at the lens of women again, you know, $100 trillion coming towards women, right? What we found when we did, Jason and I did our paper, is that very few of those Gen Xers intend to take that money to fund their retirement. So it's interesting to me, because what will happen with that money? Is that to pay down loans? Is that to pay off a house? Is that to pay off medical? You know, I don't know. We don't have the answer to that. But what we did find in the paper is that very few are seeing that, as you call it, as a parachute.
Yeah. What about younger generations? Have you looked at the people behind Gen X? I forget what they're called, X, Y, Z.
Yeah, we've got Alpha, we've got Y, we've got Z. Yes, we've got lots of letters. So the paper didn't look specifically at them, except in connection with the Gen X, at least this updated paper. So one of the things, or a number of things, come to mind, and that is that we're looking at, of course, astronomical higher ed costs. We're looking at an environment where certainly it can't be, we didn't address it in our paper, but it can't be understated, the impact of AI. And that could be, there could be some benefits, right? But there's a lot in the press, of course, talking about the headwinds for careers. We also look at the fact that the housing market is obviously pretty locked up. And that's another thing that we see, that silent and baby boomer and Gen X generation even, you know, unable to move because it will probably not necessarily save them any money. So we see that cascading down to those other generations, of course, for savings. I think we're a little more hopeful as far as maybe because there is a little bit more awareness of needing to have those personal finances, supporting them as they save and plan for retirement, that there's more.
Yeah. Well, good, because the scale was shifting from optimism to pessimism until you said that. So that helps. All right. We've talked a lot about women. Let's turn our attention to that subject. I, among other things, women, caregiving, household finance issues. Just by way of background, I teach a course at the Financial Planning Association about elder planning, helping advisors learn how to incorporate planning for older populations in their client base. And one of the interesting things, and I also took a fellowship out of Columbia University on caregiving itself, and women are, as you were going to talk about and are well aware, bear the burden, right? They leave the workforce, they suffer a loss in Social Security, suffer maybe a loss of contributing to their 401k, suffer the ability to maybe return to the workforce, all because of caregiving issues. So give us your lay of the land, and then what's the actionable advice given all those, all that pessimistic point of view?
Yeah. Well, and words matter, right? So I would maybe tweak the pessimism into a reality testing, right? Meaning it's, you know, these things are, these are the known knowns, right? It's the unknown unknowns that are the tricky part. I would add to the list the fact that women, and we'll come out of the gate, or I'll come out of the gate with a positive, which is when women are engaged in their finances, we know that they're historically better savers. So this is a fact. One of the things that happens, though, is there's kind of this label that women are risk averse. And there's a researcher out of Canada that I reference a lot, Barbara Stewart, who does an amazing survey. If people haven't seen Rich Thinking, I forget what year she's in. It's over 10. Wonderful anecdotal subjective interviews with women. One thing that I learned from her is that, again, back to language, that we talk about risk aversion with her, with everything you just said. Wouldn't it be better to think about this as risk awareness, and the fact that women, you know, were only as of, you know, 1900 allowed to own property in all states. Until the 70s, Equal Credit Act, we couldn't even get, you know, credit without a co-signature. So there's this lived experience I always talk about, where we necessarily have, and we don't get it educated in school necessarily. It's self-selection. We both came to the industry. I came from psychology, but most people aren't drawn to this. And so aware that there is this recency kind of effect of like, oh, you know, I have money, and, you know, and I can be an investor. So anyway, we know that women are good savers. The other research that I always reflect on is we've had two famous studies looking at women as investors, and we're better than men in these two studies. So there's one out of Berkeley, Boys Will Be Boys. Warwick University out of the UK did this a few years ago. Anyway, we're diversified, we trade less, you know, so it's not what you make, it's what you keep, and we're goal oriented. So I want to add that, as you say, as a counterbalance to some of these headwinds and this reality testing, and really invite women into this conversation. And again, it comes down to money is a commodity. This is something that we know does something for us. It's not just that building the pile that I talk about all the time. So I wanted to add those elements of great investors, good savers. Let's maybe flip the script a little bit on this whole labeling of women are risk averse. So those are some extra thoughts.
So when you think about becoming risk aware, Annalee Kruger is my co-instructor in this course, and she's fond of saying that a crisis is no time to plan for caregiving, right? Like by the time that happens, it's almost too late. For women who, you know, I often said when my kids were younger that I can see the future. In many cases, we can see the future. And for women who may bear the burden of caregiving largely, they may be aware of the risk, but maybe not acting on it. Or what advice do you have for folks about, one, I guess, becoming risk aware and then acting on that awareness?
Yeah. Well, it takes a village. And I would say that there are ways for us to destigmatize the conversation around this. I think using a personal example from last week, I just published A Widow's Walk, which is this idea of looking at how can we lead women through this inevitable phase, which we will have, numbers say between 11 and 14 million widows, almost a million each year. So this is a phase of life. I shared that we came up in a conversation with family, and I said to my mother, you know, have you read the paper? And she said, oh, I started it. It's too depressing. And so what I learned from that is, okay, she's 84. She's still married. That's great. I'm very fortunate, happy, healthy, married parents. What it taught me is that, you know, that support system, you know, we need to be resources for our families and our friends that are going through this. You talked about the planning. I think that I've written about this extensively, the unknown for a lot of people, of course, is how long am I going to live? But the thing that Milliman publishes each year is the cost of our healthcare. And you've already talked a little bit or touched upon cognitive decline. I mean, we're 2/3 of the Alzheimer's patients as women. And again, getting back to the advice industry, if a financial advisor is helping a woman in or through retirement and has not talked about long-term care coverage, we know that it's probably on average about $171,000. It all depends on, you know, where you live, of course. Non-long-term care costs, just out-of-pocket medical, you know, paying our Medicare premiums, what have you, prescriptions. The estimates are it's over $300,000 for women out-of-pocket in retirement. So being courageous, having these conversations in our friend groups, certainly being a resource to older, you know, family and friends, so that we're shining a light on some of these things. I know they can be paralyzing numbers. There's no question. However, back to the tools that advisors have or, you know, a consumer should know about, I have a long-term care policy, you know, and this is something that I felt was important because it gives me agency and getting, you know, a little pay in for a lot of benefit. That's smart, right? So having these conversations and being courageous, I think, is part of our job in, you know, in the industry or adjacent to the industry of sparking these conversations.
Yeah. You mentioned cognitive decline. It's one of my favorite topics. I'm often fond of quoting a Michael Finke study that was done a number of years ago where he looked at financial numeracy and said that we lose about 1 or 2% per year of our numeracy, and yet our confidence levels stay the same, which leads me to this conclusion, which is we become increasingly more confident about the bad financial decisions that we make. and so we'll get to Alzheimer's in a second, but this is just normal decline in numeracy. What do we do about that alone in terms of making sure that we make good decisions with our money? I mean, is having an advisor the answer, or is it having a sounding board, or what?
It's tricky. And recent research done by another LIMRA fellow at the Retirement Income Institute, Chris High, I reference Chris all the time. His work is really important in this space. Something he, as a researcher, has pointed attention to is that when you look at our kind of peak year of decision making financially, it's age 53. Research is saying. So yes, so Bob, we're in decline.
I know. Don't tell my wife.
Yeah. And I think it comes back to that awareness. And yes, it's going to be a blend of the head and the heart, right? Because we've got to combine emotions with this. So I love how you said competency, because I always say competency and confidence are not necessarily always aligned. And I think that's something to be hyper aware of. There are a lot of tools out there for advisors to be aware of some of the risk-taking behaviors that can happen. So personal family member is somebody who has been very risk-averse his whole life, and getting him into the mindset now of, you know, there's been significant accumulation, but it's been a hobby and it's been something fun. And so there's not necessarily, again, it's my value system, but it's not necessarily something that I would think is prudent to just say, let's go long, let's have some fun. And I think there's something there with that money personality. So I write about this a lot. There are lots of money personality assessments out there. One of the more famous ones developed by Brad Klontz is Money Scripts. But I think as an advisor, really helping, especially aging people, navigate what could be driving, because we all have money stories and they're set really young. And so helping build that awareness and then marrying it with sort of the math and, you know, what is the objective with this money? So I think education's a key. Yeah.
Once I interviewed Michael Finke, and he gave me this phrase, which I thought was interesting. He said, have your 65-year-old self think about your 85-year-old self so that you take the decisions away from that older person, because you know that maybe they're inclined to make bad decisions about their money. But if you make it at 65, i.e. maybe you're purchasing an annuity, for instance, and you're creating protected income, that you've done a favor for your 85-year-old self.
Exactly. And something that Chris has written about as well, which I love to share, is to your point, Bob, that simplifying decision making as well, because let's be honest, as we age, you know, we want to be doing, hopefully we are aligned with our purpose and we want to be doing more fun things. And having a guaranteed income stream from an annuity does create two things, or creates at least two things, which is it simplifies. You're not having to make a decision about, oh, what am I, seling in my portfolio, or what am I buying to create income? So that makes life easier. And then it's also creating that predictable income. So another family member is going through this with her mother, where she is terrified about living her income. And it's a absolute compulsion and fear and creating all this negative emotion on, do I have enough money? And we know from referencing early papers, having a guaranteed income stream, whether it's a pension, whether it's Social Security or an annuity, creates this kind of safety and security feeling. So yes, I think simplifying things, and I might add one more thing because you I'm sure teach on this, Bob, which is the senior fraud. And these confidence scams that are getting worse and worse and worse, the billions and billions of dollars that seniors are losing each year to these scams, it's a concern.
Yeah, the one thing I'll make mention of, I just gave a speech on this for the AICPA conference, and a little known tool is something that the FBI has called the fraudulent kill chain. And so for anyone listening, if you are scammed, call the institution from which the money was taken, and have it revoked, and then call, not call, but email the FBI at their IC3.gov site. And you can report it. And they've had good success in recovering money, which is not often the case in these scams, as you well know, whether it's a romance scam or a business or email scam or a grandparent scam or whatever it might be. But there is some hope. But the unfortunate thing, Suzanne, is only 1 in 25 cases get reported. So people are embarrassed that it happened or they don't know who to turn to or whatever the case may be. There are resources out there to help. So especially the FBI.
Well, and I'll tee up a resource that I co-chair CFA Society Boston's Financial Literacy Initiative, one of the longest in the country, the world. And we have an incredible amount of volunteers, no conflict of interest. We have a new senior fraud presentation that we give. And we tend to track that through the libraries because there is, a quick visibility. So yes, and one other, proactive step that I would encourage people to think about, which I'm sure you talk about, which is credit freezes. I've done that for my parents, and I can't stop getting them to click on links. That's another problem. But credit freezes, a really easy first step.
Yeah. Suzanne, this has been a great conversation. Anything we missed or anything that bears reemphasizing that you want to mention before we wrap up?
I appreciate the discussion. There's hours and hours of this topic that we could share, and I just want to say I appreciate the opportunity and certainly everything that I've written about. I encourage people to take a look, and please take a look at LIMRA's consumer site, and we have a lot of resources there.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom. We'll have you come back and talk about things we didn't get to today at some point in the near future. So.